Hello, it's Kathy Love here. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. So no big surprise at all, I like to talk a lot. And now I can share some of the incredible people who crossed my path and the interesting conversations that we have. The Private Practice Secrets podcast is all about harnessing and sharing this collective business know-how, the experience, and the wisdom. My guests are amazing. They're bold, they're brave, and they're honest. There are laughs, and surprisingly, there's often talk of wine. We think you're really going to enjoy these unplugged private practice chats. So come on in, pull up a chair, let's get the conversation started.
So, Dino Manillo, it's great to have you on this podcast. We've spoken more in the last week than we have in the last 2 years, so I'm looking forward to a really good catch-up, so I guess our listeners will just have to bear with us. Dino's the founding director of Occupational Therapy for Children, which is a fabulous practice in Adelaide. So when we hear Adelaide, we think NDIS, so I'm sure we'll cover that at some point. But Dino, maybe quickly bring us up to speed. I know you started in mental health and you've worked interstate and then back to Adelaide, I think 2012, 2013. So how did your business begin?
Well, it really was about opportunities that came up at a certain time. I took advice for you after I had finished working in Melbourne with you. I came back to Adelaide and you suggested that I speak to a lady called Veronica Spear, who had a private practice. And I went there initially because I was going to ask her about how to start up a private practice in Adelaide and who to connect with. Unfortunately for her, but fortunately for me, somebody in her practice broke their arm. And so she had a 6-week to 8-week contract available, and she offered that opportunity for me to work there, which I took up. I think in hindsight, she was ready to look at other options and moving on. She was involved in studying kinesiology, and I was really happy at that stage. Having a young family, I needed some work. So after a short period of time, she started to talk to me about the possibility of taking over the practice that she'd started and had for about 20 years in Adelaide. So in the course of 2014, we worked some things out with accountants and figures and things like that, and the opportunity was there. And at that time, it was pretty hard for money. So Michelle's my wife and business partner, we were fortunate that my parents could provide the backing for us to get a loan from the bank, and we started the business. And pretty soon, things went from bad to worse at that point because the therapists that were there left either through looking at other opportunities or wanting to move on. So I was on my own for a while, working really hard. And we moved site pretty quickly to look at eventually expanding the business. At the start, there was just me and a part-time receptionist and Michelle at home with a baby doing some accounts and admin stuff. And then it moved to where we are today, which is goodness me, many years on. We've had the practice for 12 years now, and we have a staff of 10 OTs and 4 admin and a HR or a business manager, which is Michelle. So that's where we are today.
Yeah. I don't think I did the math right. You must have moved back to Adelaide in the early 2000s.
No, 2003. Yeah. Isabella was born in 2003. Yeah. So it wasn't long after that that I started working for Veronica, and then in 2005 we took over the business then. So yeah, I worked for CAMS for a little while when I came back part time for Veronica and CAMS, but once we took over the business, it was full time for me.
Yeah, what did you know about business back then?
You know, my father had his own business for many, many years. He was in structural steel, but so I guess being around that, you learn. You learn one really, really important thing is that they work really hard and they work very long hours. And so you're prepared in some way to realize that you sacrifice things, I guess, particularly early on. Certainly towards the end of his career where he sold his business, he was able to delegate more and I guess spend more time maybe outside of the business. But I know for 15 years or so, you know, we hardly saw him on weekends. He was always busy working, and that's just what life was for him. So I knew it would always be hard work.
How many hours a week were you working in those early years? I don't want to know the answer.
I'm probably embarrassed to say, but I would work I never really calculated the hours, but I know what rate I was on in the first 4 years, and I was on about $7 an hour for the hours that I worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would work, you know, I'd be at the practice, you know, between 7, you know, usually about 7:30 I'd be there, and then I'd leave at 6, come home, spend time with Michelle and with Isabella at that stage, and then I would go back to work at probably 7 till 12, 1 o'clock. That was, you know, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 for at least the first four years. So you do the math, they're ridiculous hours.
Yeah, I remember all of that. And I remember thinking, wow, the kids are in bed, now I can get back to, or not even necessarily looking forward to it, but just knowing that from 8 till 11:30 at night, you had all of the admin and the billing and the accounts. And because I didn't really understand it very well at the start, it took so much longer. And there wasn't the technology available today to make any of that any easier. So it was a real old school hard slog.
I think I was more fortunate. I had Michelle who would do a lot of the accounts and, you know, and settlements and things like that. But it was more the guilt I think I associated with not being able to spend that time with, you know, with family. And also when you're out at a function, a family function, my thinking and was always about what I had to do with work after. And Michelle used to say that I had this look on my face of I was there, but I wasn't really there.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. It's only now that I'm able to separate both. I think, wow, it's such a relief to not to be to, when you're not at work, to not have to think about work. But in that early stage, I didn't really have anyone around me to ask for guidance or for mentoring in relation to that. I think the thought process back then was it's a grind and you've got to do the hours and the grind. But nowadays, if you look into and I'm really lucky because I don't read a lot about business management and I don't attend courses. Michelle does all of it, so she's my reference, and so she'll bring in this article or she'll have this idea and she'll say, it's not about working more hours; it's about working more effectively and continuing to provide the same level of service and have the same stamina to be able to do that each day." And I think that's what's changed for us really in the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, absolutely. That's quite an ideal combination and you've made it work so brilliantly. If you've got a clinical brain matching with a business brain, that is a recipe for awesome. But it's really unusual. I can't think of any other kind of husband, wife, private practice, kind of situation. So good on you. So I've seen your rooms in Weymouth Street. I saw them a couple of years ago. They're absolutely beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And you've really invested in your clients, I guess, with that gorgeous waiting area. I've got a visual of what it looks like, but you've got 3 or 4 rooms, full sensory gyms going, or is it more?
Yeah, so we took over the building, the whole building, in stages. So we did initially at first, we only had 2 treatment rooms and an assessment room. And then over the course of 7 years, we now have the whole building and we have 6 treatment rooms plus an assessment room. We still provide a service to selected schools on other days, but primarily we're a clinic-based service. So we have upstairs 4 treatment rooms plus an assessment room and 2 more treatment rooms downstairs. And downstairs we have an operable wall, so we open up that treatment room into a larger room to run some group programs as well. So we were able to do that at the start of last year, which has really, I guess, changed the practice in terms of providing a different service, but also being dynamic and not just sticking with the sensory integration work that is synonymous with this practice, but more so expanding it further as well.
So I'm hearing that I know you love your individual SI-based work, but what's I've been trying to shift you and talked about that for years. Tell me what's driven the change to more group-based stuff, group-based programs.
Look, Kathy, I think it's about listening to what the families and the clients really want. They want things that are going to help develop their children beyond the physical elements and, say, the sensory issues that they present with. And, you know, once they're at a stage, what else do they acquire in terms of life skills and social skills and work opportunities? So, you know, for a lot of them, it is handwriting that they want. They want their children to be better at handwriting. And we, you know, even though I'm probably the least motivated with handwriting, it's something that we provide because they are wanting to stay in the service, but are wanting, and we ask them, what do you want us to develop? You know, where do you want OTFC to go? So, you know, our primary stakeholders really are our clients. So we have to listen to them. And if we don't, then potentially that's an area that, you know, competitors will move into, and they obviously do. But, you know, we're trying to be dynamic. And I think that's one of the things that Michelle emphasizes in our management meetings is we need to be looking at what else and what else can we provide, where else can we go. And that's a two-way street there, because not only are we providing those opportunities for the clients, but also for therapists, because, you know, people don't want to be stuck doing one, especially in PEDS, one style of therapy. They want to explore, and especially if they're younger, they want to see what else is available. And if we can't provide that, they'll move on. So many reasons why we're doing that. And, you know, I've worked in group programs. I worked in adolescent mental health, and I've always wanted to be able to provide an ongoing service for that clientele. So we're moving. We've just acquired, as of 2 days ago, a new premises that we are knocking down and doing a custom build for a larger warehouse-type gym that we can service adolescents to adults. And within that, we've got plans for a garden to have a, you know, like a local garden that these kids can come and be a part of and incorporate and hopefully move into more community-based promotion for our kids, especially the kids that we service the most, which are the kids with ASD, whether they're low-functioning or high-functioning. Often that's an area that parents struggle. There are little avenues forward for them. So we're branching into that area because that's been the area of need that's the highest at this point in time, especially with the NDIS that's come through, and the one that there is very little service providers for that in Adelaide anyway.
I can imagine it's absolute natural fit for you because you've got your mental health piece as well, and you've got all those early years of mental health, and that with the teens and the 13 pluses and all the flavours on the autism spectrum and other kids that are funded as well. I can see that as, I can just see you in your element in that new build and in that new project and designing those services.
Well, I never realised how much the background in mental health was complementary to work in PEDS. And you're dealing with complex issues with families, and even if they're privately and the families are supportive, often there are dynamics within that you don't realise that you're drawing on that training and that expertise. It's not that they have the acute psychoses and things like that. It's more about managing personalities and using a lot of the CBT-based approaches as well. And, you know, really, sometimes children don't want to talk about their issues and problems when they're younger. Sometimes you're getting them involved in classic OT occupational stuff, and they'll talk more about some of the things that bother them and how you can work through that. So, I mean, I'm initially never reluctant to work in mental health, but it was never a glamour area to work in. But I utilize those skills, and we look for those traits in prospective employees as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So when are the doors going to be opening on this? I can see the eye roll. I'll just let the readers know of the eye roll. When are the doors going to be opening on this teen service and this new additional centre?
So we are as of, so we've got a 45 day
on the agreement.
Yeah, we've got a 45 day settlement, which means that probably in early April we are able to demolish and then go in. Michelle is a coordinator of everything. She said she'll have it done in 6 months, and to be honest, she'll get it done because the renovation that we had at Weymouth Street, she did that in about 4 months when it should have probably been about 12. So we have good connections in the building industry. So, you know, we're fortunate from that perspective. At the latest, end of the year, that's where we're looking to be
open. So my geography of Adelaide, despite having lived there, is really dodgy. Whereabouts is it? Where will it be?
Adelaide is such a long and unchanging state in many regards. So we're located right in the city. So we're on the west end of the city, which is very accessible to everybody. But the new place is 2 minutes down the road in a semi-industrial area, but it's not really industrial. They're actually building a big freeway in Adelaide now that goes from north to south, and we're located about a street back from that. I'm allowed to jive about Adelaide because I live here. So it's going to be accessible to the further regions, north and south, for those families who'll be able to get in within 25 minutes to the city. So,
got it.
You know, getting in is not a problem. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, Wow. Well, please keep me updated on that. I just think that is incredible. And the word that has been popping up for years and years in every other sector other than disability is innovation. And we're only just starting to hear about innovation in the disability sector. And I guess we're hearing it kind of as a tagline of the NDIS. So you are an absolute pioneer over in Adelaide with the NDIS. How have you navigated it?
It's been punishing, to be completely honest.
Because, I won't edit that out.
Because the planning for it didn't take into account consulting, really, the private practice sector that was going to be heavily influenced by it. Mm-hmm. So we took a good 12 months to plan, and what that meant for us was increasing our infrastructure in admin primarily by probably about 50%.
Wow.
And so those costs are quite significant, because if you don't, then you don't run a practice well. So, you know, we are so heavy in admin, because we have to be, that the NDIS may generate or predict that you can be viable from a business perspective because of the turnover. But we have found that the actual profit margin has not increased. In fact, it has decreased slightly. And in from a business perspective, we took a very deliberate stance to never have more than 50% of our clients NDIS based. We never relied on them for referrals to start with. And to be honest, the benefit is it has accelerated our growth. So we would have got there eventually. This has just meant probably 5 years in advance that we're at now without the NDIS. But what it's meant also then is we have to outlay a lot more capital, and we have to absorb that, and we have to have had the capital to be able to absorb that as well. And I think smaller businesses may not manage that very well. I know a lot of practices where there is, you know, that like I was initially, where we were doing everything, that they are doing their NDIS paperwork, that they're having to factor that in as well as being a clinician as well. And I don't know where they would actually find the hour. So a lot of them fall behind. A lot of them are struggling at having to look for ways around that. So if NDIS has been a wonderful thing for the families and the clients, but it from an operational perspective, it's been extremely difficult, and it changes all the time. So we have to change with that as well. And there are big non-government organisations and government organisations that also access NDIS. So they've shifted their model, but we're competing with that sector as well. Whereas previously we were a private sector, and you know, the disability services managed clients that were government funded, whereas now we're all in the same situation.
Yeah. With a guesstimate, how much has the competition changed?
Well, I think there's been at least a 50% increase in private services that are offered. It doesn't mean that the growth is similar to what ours would be in terms of a larger organisation. There has been a lot more therapists that traditionally worked in, say, disability services, or here we have Novita services, that were there for a while and then decided to move out into and form their own practice, and maybe had one or two therapists. And there aren't many clinic-based services, so they provide a lot of those services within schools. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, a lot of the schools and education systems have now, they're not allowing therapists to come into the schools anymore.
Because they were getting about that.
Yeah.
Wow. So how is NDIS working or not working with education and schools and school visits at the moment?
Well, what's happening is that schools, they're actually inquiring about having a therapist who they can not contract, but having a service agreement with, that then the families are encouraged to take that service, which defeats the purpose of the NDIS in giving families choice. But
yeah.
Understandably, from the school's perspective, they can't suddenly find five rooms for three OT, two speeches or a psych to work with children. And so it has changed the landscape a little bit. I've found that, like this year, we were approached by two schools to be able to provide, to have a service agreement with, because they want our service within the school. And that's changed in the past, from having to go out and start, you know, to working with kids in schools and then, you know, acquiring more families. And obviously if the school is happy, they recommend the therapist. So in many ways, I don't really know how that aspect of therapy or the NDIS changes, because we still are very much a clinic-based service for 85% of our service.
Yeah.
But I imagine it is causing a lot of anxiety for those practitioners that are that are hoping to acquire or working with children for a long time, and then are told, well, you can't come into this school at this time. So but again, that changes all the time.
Yeah, I'm hearing from all over the country exactly that. The smaller businesses that are perhaps home-based or may have sessional rooms, but who really do most of their work in schools, that the gate is just being closed, with schools saying those appointments need to happen out of school hours. And we know when we work with little people, there's only really 2 or 3 hours outside of school hours that you can book it in. So it's proving quite confronting. And I don't think we've quite got to the bottom of the NDIS and the school kind of piece. I think there's a bit of work being done at quite high levels around that. So I suspect there's going to be more changes and more conversation about this as well. And there's state and federal reviews going on in terms of the support that students with disabilities need. So it still feels very muddy and murky. So I hope it changes and I hope it works well. Ultimately, it's the students that are, I guess, potentially got the most to lose. Awful.
Well, they are shifting towards more community-based programs and supporting children within, and asking therapists to be able to set programs and act more as case managers, I think, in terms of linking clients and families in, as opposed to providing direct therapy, which is a huge shift. And I think the drive for that is that the amount of money that has been spent on children absolutely exceeded their expectation and their budget. Mm. And so if they don't change, then the NDIS won't be able to be sustained. So a lot of our families coming into their third year now of their NDIS plans have had them reduced by, 50 and 60%. We're told families are telling us that they're being told that after the age of, I think it's 8 years of age, their child is no longer in a category where they can acquire the higher bracket of funding as well. So, parents are very anxious as well about this, I guess, this pool of funding that they initially thought they had and then is being taken away. Now, for clients that traditionally wouldn't possibly need access to that funding, and it's been, I think, in a lot of respects, it's been almost given away initially. The ones that are severe, who've relied on that funding for, equipment provision and more complex needs, they're also having their funding cut. And then, the parents are really anxious about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hearing that as well. And I've heard that in Adelaide that you need a diagnosis, or is it over 8 you need a diagnosis, but under 8 you're part of the early intervention stream, but that's really different to Barwon and Newcastle. And so there's, nationwide inconsistencies as well. So I guess that kind of, it's very uncertain. But it also makes it really hard for the disability advocacy groups to advocate, because there are so many spinning plates that affect things so deeply at a local level that it's quite a smorgasbord of negotiations, I guess.
Well, and that's where you see a lot of people are going into advocacy as well, because they're finding that unless they can present themselves in a manner to an NDIS planner, then they're less likely to get the funding that they need. And so it then becomes a case of, it's not reliant on what the child needs are, then also it's also reliant on how well the parent can convey what the issues that are existing for their children. So, we encourage them to have those assessments and have that paperwork and have somebody go there with them and make sure that there is an advocate there who can support them.
Yeah. How many of your families self-manage their funds?
Lots. We encourage lots, because the amount of admin time that it takes for us, even though it is billable, is enormous. There are people that would generate huge amounts of income by generating plans and managing those for families. But in general, our families, we provide support for them, but we encourage them to be able to manage theirs themselves if they can, because that means that more of that money goes to the child, and that's, we're seeing a lot of families coming in with using significant portion of their funding through managing their plan, and it's not direct service to their child. So it's necessary for some families, but we would have very few now, and I don't know what the percentage is exactly, but I know that Michelle in the management meeting said, we need to shift this because we can't provide this service and continue to provide the level of service effectively unless we employ people just to do those, to be NDIS planners or managers. It's really difficult.
Yeah. I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And there's mixed emotions, I guess, about the planning function and the management function and the case management, which is just a dreadful expression, and the self-managed funds as well, and the time and the money that can pour in and out of those roles. So, yeah. Now, you've got a really big admin team. Who's on your team? Who's in the building in terms of clinicians and admin?
Okay, so I'm the clinical director and Michelle is the HR director. So Michelle, about 4 years ago, her background is a radiation therapist, so she's in health science, but she completed an MBA. She did an MBA. And to be honest, Kathy, that was the start of the change in our business that has been life-saving for me, but also progressed our business, you know, to a point that it's managed so well. I initially thought that I could, and Michelle, that we could do it, but it's impossible. You have to invest heavily into that infrastructure. And we have an admin manager who works in admin, but also is part of our management team. We have three admin staff. We have the equivalent every day of at least three full-time admin staff.
Wow.
Plus, I have a beautiful lady who works from home and types all my reports. So I dictate all of my reports, as do the two other therapists who do assessments. So she works at home full-time. You know, she does 30 hours a week typing reports. So she's part of our...
She must love you so much.
She is happy because it works for her and she loves hearing my voice every day. Every month or so, how can you stand hearing my voice every day? She's been with us for over 6 years and has really saved my life. So that's because I would do the reports at night. So now I dictate in 15 minutes every report and that gets done so quickly. So aside from that and that admin team, we then have 10 treating therapists, the equivalent to about 7.5, 8 full-time OCs. And then, because we might run also Monday to Saturday as well, so we're one of the only practices that works on the services families on a Saturday as well in Adelaide. Not many do. And then we also have a developmental educator who we brought in, and she has a background in health science and has been running she's been the Jimbaroo guru in Adelaide for many, many years. So her knowledge in working with children, and she is providing that extra service at home for families, particularly NDIS clients who need follow-up with activities at home, need help with organisation, need help with even basic parenting, toileting, routines, things like that, which has been absolutely fantastic. But you have to have the right person for that. And so she really embraces that and loves that work. So she was a great addition to our team in over the last 18 months or so. So, I mean, that's us. And we're always looking who's out there. We're always interviewing or we're networking and finding out who would be a good fit for the practice. And our interview process and recruitment process is an important part. It's no longer so-and-so worked there and they're not happy where they are and they've worked a bit in peas. You know, we're really looking at maintaining our own staff, and then we're getting really good OTs apply to work for us. And having to say no to a fantastic OT is difficult, but is a good reflection of where we are in terms of our practice.
Yeah, it sounds like you're an employer of choice, which is really well deserved. And it's a lovely position to be in where you get emails and website inquiries coming in. And it means it's great for profile, it's great for business, but it's also great for building relationships because you just don't know when you're going to need someone next or when your circumstances change. And I was always very curious. I always tried to meet everyone who ever applied for anything or inquired just to find out what they were doing and where else they'd worked and what was happening at that place. And that curiosity part is really nicely met as well when you're always catching up with those those inquiries. It's good.
I'm like you. I always at least spend half an hour with whoever's applied or whoever has shown interest in working at the practice, because I think that also motivates them to keep looking, even if you don't have a place or they're not suitable. I think, you know, I always found that difficult when you know, if I was looking for an avenue impedes that, you know, I guess the door was shut more than it was open. And so, you know, you can be discouraged by that. And I think that I was very fortunate that you were interested in at least open your door to have a conversation with me. And that inspired me to really be motivated to force you to give me a job.
It wasn't hard. It wasn't hard at all. There was no bribery involved. So your business and your team is rocking along. What do you guys do brilliantly?
Okay. That was interesting. I think in terms of, and Michelle and I spoke about that. So, well, it's interesting because reflection is something that I don't often do, but Michelle does a lot of. And I think the one thing that I think that we do is we don't stay stagnant. We don't look at what's worked in the past and say that has to be the model going forward. We look at all avenues of business, including social media. That was a huge area for us within the last 24 months that I saw it, not as needing referrals. We never needed to gain referrals, but we've always needed to have a presence. And I think that social media and the, you know, whether you've got Facebook, the blog, your website, Instagram, all these things were foreign to me, and understanding that or knowing who to delegate that to in the practice. So we have a therapist that works a day on social media and he does the blog, and I don't have to do those things. Sometimes I write an article and he makes it look pretty and puts it up, but generally they generate that themselves, and families love that. I think we look at best practice as well. Kathy, that's why we've changed from saying, okay, SI is the only area that we have to work. And we say, well, best practice is saying it's not, but we value what we do, but we can also expand and include other avenues of occupational therapy to service our families and clients. And the other one is being not...
doing a happy dance.
Happy because you thought I was so... But I love SI I love the work that we do with kids. It's you know, being a physically active person and seeing those kids change, I've always believed that's my fit, but it didn't mean that we would stay there. And yep. So
lots of ways to be right.
And not being reactive. That was another big one that we said is a really important part of our practice, and what makes us a bit different is things happen, and whether it's NDIS or whether it's changes in Medicare and or, you know, restrictions in terms of practice that come out, but not being reactive to that, you know, not jumping up and down and changing things at that instant because you feel that, well, we need to take advantage of that. It's about planning, and we utilize our management team and we consult as well outside of our practice to say where, you know, this is happening, what's a recommendation? And then we make the decisions. Michelle and I make the decisions, but not being reactive has been a very important part of our growth as a business as well.
Very, very cool. I used to have a post-it note on my desk, and I can't see it right now, that is essentially don't panic, plan. And that sounds like some of the things that you and Michelle might have been, had front of mind as well. So we were talking about what you're proud of, and an awesome, awesome list. And I was just kind of talking about the planning kind of piece. So do you guys have a business plan?
Yes, we do now. early on, I just said it was about hard work, and I was blind in that I needed to make ends meet early on. And I said, if I do really good work and work hard, then the business will take care of itself. And it did to a point. And I think maybe in some ways that I felt justified, and I ignored Michelle's recommendations that we should have a business plan. But again, at one point I let go and I said, okay, I think you know more about the business management of OTFC than I actually will ever know and ever want to know. So I'm going to hand over all of that to you. And so what she then did was, you know, we have a beautiful accountant who's been in our family, you know, his father was my dad's accountant. So he's always given great advice. But Michelle really sat down and had this business plan. What that meant was she would cancel out a day and make me sit there and have to say, where are we going? What are we? And ask these questions. And we worked through these things. And it was difficult for me in at the start, not because of the control issue for me, but more of a case of I just wanted to be working with the kids. I didn't want to be out of the clinic, and I didn't want to do anything else other than provide what I knew I was really good at. But, you know, in the last 4 years, having brought in Alison Moss, who works for me, who works for us, is our clinical manager. So she's part of our clinical management team. We have another therapist who is fantastic, and he's part of the management team. And then there's Joanne, who's the admin manager. And so there's five of us or six of us that meet probably, I'd say once every school term, or equivalent to once every school term, and we have a planning day, and we have, where's the business at? Where are we going? What? How do we make it happen? What do we need to do? So that's our business plan, and that gets, you know, that gets noted, and that gets looked at, and that gets referenced, and people have jobs. And if you don't do what's set in that plan moving forward, then you're asked why, including me. So I'm accountable a lot more in the business than I ever was. Now, that doesn't mean I always get everything done, but what it does, it encourages me to keep that in my mind when I'm at those meetings, or when I need to start looking at, okay, we do need to acquire a new premises, or we need to plan in advance about, you know, what service and who do I need to contact for this and that. So it's very much more so now than it ever was, a very integral and important part of our business. And I think essentially if I was not so stubborn early on, it potentially would have been even more helpful.
Wow, high five to you. We haven't had a beer together for a couple of years, but just wine comes up on virtually every podcast if you ever get to listen to them all. But hearing the language that you use and hearing the way you talk about it and hearing the big picture stuff is just amazing. I am so uber impressed. Good on you guys. And I really should have Michelle on this podcast as well, by the sounds of things.
That's what she said. She said, why did she? I said, you know what? I said, you know more than I do. You're gonna have to fill me in about stuff that I should be talking about. And we just had a laugh. But she's in the front room. I know she's listening. But you know, it is really a. I know you're laughing at me, but I did grow up. Like I'm over 40, so I actually had to grow up and not realize that just hanging out with kids and doing stuff with kids was the way to go, even though it's still what I love doing and I get to do most of the time. It is a business, you know, and that business is important because we're providing a service, and that is the bottom line, is that quality of service to our families. And, you know, it is. I don't have an interest in going to business courses, but I have an interest in picking my brain's wife after she's read a book. You know, I said, what books are we reading? She goes, you don't read any of the books about business development. I read them all. But then she tells me about them. So I get this synopsis of these brilliant business people and the books that she's read, and she reads them all the time. And, you know, and it's great because a lot of those strategies we can implement. And so it's funny you say she should be sitting here because
well,
I'm sure.
Go and get her.
Michi, do you want to come here? No, she's saying no. She can hear me.
I'll have a wine with Michelle next time I'm in Adelaide. I'll get the gossip. I'll get the what's really going on. But I'm super impressed. I think it's absolutely amazing. And I guess it's something that we've both experienced now in that evolution of self and evolution of business and really getting your business brain switched on. And I think it's fair to say it's not just about the money. It's actually about having the money and the opportunity as a form of energy to be able to run a great business, be a great employer, have a great team, change the lives of the people that you work with, but also to work with the parents to enhance the lives of the kids. And that's been a huge theme for me and a huge motivator for me. Oh my gosh, through all the blood, sweat and tears, that's the stuff that kept me kind of focused and reasonably sane. I don't know how sane, but and it's something I hear from lots of the people that I talk to, that they actually really want to be doing it better for business team and families.
Absolutely. I love my job. I don't ever wake up any day thinking I don't want to go to work. I think back to, you know, my life as a professional footballer, and people say, oh, being a sportsman would be the best thing in your life. I would not trade what I'm doing now for that ever. And in fact, I'm glad that I did that because things I learned out of that have been helpful. But, you know, the bottom line is I essentially think OTs, particularly those that work with in our area, do it because they see it as a career, and that career is providing opportunities for servicing families, whether that's therapy, whether that's support, but making a difference to their lives. And you can't really fake that. There's no way to look at it as a money generating business. You have to look at it as doing something that you love. And if you do what you love and you're passionate about it, things happen. And a part of that is a financial reward as well. I mean, I'm able to provide for my family, and we're you know, we live a comfortable life, but we pour so much money back into the business because we see it as something that we're passionate about, and the growth there is necessary. And sometimes it sounds a bit, you know, people say, oh, you know, you've got a calling in life and things like that, but you don't think about that every day when you're doing it. That's what you think you're meant to do. And there are lots of people in the world that make a lot more money and are extremely unhappy and watch the time go by. And I always think, what happened to my day today? It was 7:30 and now it's 5:30 and I actually have to get home. So, you know, I think if that's how your life is and your work is, it can't be too bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What does your week look like?
So now, in the last 3 years, I've worked clinically 4 days a week. And so on a Friday, which is today, I can do things like this. I can chat to you. I can go and have lunch. I can take Michelle out. I can go out and meet a friend. I can consult. I can go and have a chat with the principal at school about a program, which I'm doing this afternoon, about enhancing children's development, not only working with kids at one end of the spectrum, but working with the kids that are elite as well. So we're looking at a program that's implemented in a school. So these interesting things come up because I have time. I sometimes have to repair equipment and do boring stuff. But generally on Saturdays and Sundays, it's more about, I still play soccer and I still coach and am involved with soccer. That's my time outside of, I guess, of family and work. So I still commit to being really physically active. So I'm up about 5 in the morning and you're off to the gym because that's, you know, the time that you go to the gym in the morning. And then, you know, I only sleep 5 or 6 hours.
That's not much. But I
find if I sleep more than that, I'm non-functional. So everybody, you have to find what works
true.
For you.
Very true.
So, you know, I knew of a guy in who had a business and he only slept 3 hours a night. And I just couldn't believe how he could function on that. But he's still alive, believe it or not, into his 70s. And he's really happy, but that's my balance. And then, you know, really Sundays is our family time. And in between that, when you have teenagers, your children grow, as yours are much older than mine. But I remember seeing your kids and thinking they're happy, they're around you all the time. And our kids are around us and are involved in the practice as well. And, you know, they have to be a part of that and we have to be a part of their life. So I coach my son Noah's soccer team and Isabella's in performing arts. So we go to those performances and Michelle does a lot of that extra work outside of the school hours time and it's not easy, Kathy. You know, there are moments where we have discussions about me not doing enough of that and that she needs a bit of a break. So it's because she works just as many hours in the practice as I do, but my contact time is so set that it's really hard to break away. But I book in advance, you know, swimming carnival or, you know, something special at school so that I know that I'm there for that as well.
Yeah.
Because I never criticised my dad for working 7 days a week and not being there for a lot of my childhood. But I wanted to be a part of my children's life and my family life because it's guilty. I feel guilty. If I'm working so much with kids but I can't spend time with my own kids, then that doesn't work either. So my week is good. Like, I like my balance. It's you know, the 4 days are really full on, but you know, you you had something about lunch, right?
And
you
spoke about lunch. Yeah, I've got a question about lunch. What do you do for lunch?
I have a stock, Michelle, and I have a stock in the fridge, a supply of, and you're going to laugh because probably some other OTs will have the same.
Tin tuna?
But our stocks, yep, tin tuna, tin corn, tin bean, and I like dill gherkins, so I have those. And that is thrown together pretty much nearly every day in 10 minutes. And you eat it while you're looking through something, responding to an email, having supervision. I have an open door policy. I have to mentor 10 OTs. So I have to find time for supervision outside of my clinical time that I supervise because I you know, we guarantee that as part of what happens in our practice. And everybody needs that, including me. I seek mentoring still with Veronica because I need that for myself. And our conversations, you know, that's important more so from you from a business perspective because that's helpful for me to say, you know, you need to look at these things as well. Don't just get stuck in there. So, you know, that day's lunch is, if you can get it. Occasionally, I will have an hour. If there's a cancellation, I'll say, we're going to get out. We're going to have lunch somewhere. but it's, you know, very rare. It's not a thing that you look at and go, woe is me, I don't have a lunch break. It's just that I know I need to provide fuel for myself, so I've got to have that and then I can move on. But I would always rather be busy than sitting around doing nothing.
Yep, I guess. Yes, absolutely. So one of the other questions that I provided to you before the call was a bit of a hypothetical. So if 50 grand arrived in your bank account, no questions asked, and it was all yours to put to the business, what would you do with them?
I knew you were going to ask that question. Do you know what? At this point in time, I'd put it towards OTFC Plus, which is our new business venture. You know, I would put it towards optimizing what we could in that aspect. That's a, you know, that's going to end up about a $1.2 million venture. And so anything would help, whether that's for equipment.
Pay the interest.
You know, if it was outside of that, I would love to put that towards funding a costless camp for families. You know, I think that, you know, the camp that we have is funded through, for a majority of our clients, through NDIS or privately. And I think I'd love to do something like that as a means for, you know, providing back to them without having to charge them for that time.
Yeah. I tend to hear that it's about new rooms or new equipment or services or some scholarships and grants for kids to come in who wouldn't ordinarily have access. So, yeah, that all sounds amazing. Now, you mentioned the camp. And I'm not sure if you've been running camps already, but I know you've got some camps coming up. So when I think of camps, I think of the American model, and I've done sensory camps 20 years ago. That dates me enormously, in Colorado. And it was a fascinating few days, absolutely extraordinary. What are you up to in that department?
Well, firstly, you can come along to our camp. You can join in. You'll fit in really well.
Manage all my sensory issues.
Yeah. Not as a participant. You can be part of us, part of the therapy team. We're running the first sensory-based camp in South Australia because a lot of our families have been to New South Wales and been part of the Sensory Gym One. Some even go overseas, and we said, well, what we can do this. We have two staff members that paid themselves to go and be a part of that camp in New South Wales, and we said to one of them, as part of, because all of our employees have to have their own portfolio, and this one we encouraged her to say, okay, you be the camp person, you give us the details, we'll generate with you what the plan. So it's loosely based on that, but you know, we've got a three-day sleepover camp. There's a group of children. There's three groups, and the younger group won't sleep over. They'll just come every day. But it's a full-on sensory. We're going to have massive water slides, you know, mud baths. We're going to have T-shirt painting. We're going to have spaghetti baths. We're going to do the whole lot. And it's really about trying to provide. Oh, you know what? It's fun.
It's fun. It's good sensory fun. Have you got a name for it?
It's called Camp Evolve.
Nice.
And so it's on our website, and families register. And we're only taking OTSD clients because we have a process of eligibility for the camp, and we know all the children. So, and really, we have enough children to be able to place them the numbers. So they're really for families that have been involved in our practice for a period of time, and that we are moving them towards saying, this is what's available in the community. A lot of these kids have never been on camp. This is the first time, and it's very difficult for parents to let go as well, to say, I'm not ready for my child to sleep over. But there's an element of trust there. So there's this interesting dynamic where I'm sure a lot of them will want to drive up and see what's going on. But the model of it is loosely based on what exists, but we wanted something different. We didn't want it to be set in a certain way. And so we interviewed a lot of university students. So we have acquired, you know, 10 or so uni students who are enthusiastic about coming along and being supports for our staff in that camp and for the kids as well. So it's exciting. I just think it's brilliant. I love camp.
Yeah. Oh, well, send me the dates. Never say never. Just be
Absolutely.
Careful. Just be careful what you wish for, Dina. Just be careful. So 2017 is sounding just mind-boggling. Is there, you've got the new program for the teens, you've got the new build, you've got the camps. Any other kind of secret sauce or highlights you can share?
pilot account, look, we're looking at research as well, Kathy. So when I think about that $50,000, I think, you know, we could probably put that towards research in our practice, in what we do, not only the SI, but also about our model of practice and developing a model of practice that might be, I guess, sustainable outside of what Michelle and I offer, but being replicated as well, and saying, you know what, this is a good model. It can change, but we're looking at that avenue as well. So I guess that's enough. I can't think about having a new place and having all these new programs and a camp and us being able to manage anything else. I'm sure that Michelle will bring something next month. Have a look at this. This looks really interesting. Why don't we go into this area or have a look at what could this provide for our family? We outsource as well outside of OT. Like, there's some amazing people out there that, you know, that really have lots to offer. Having said that, we're getting the gurus in SI from the US. We've paid for them to come over and train all of our staff as well. So they're, over the period of 12 months of 4 weekly sessions, they are doing the SI certification for pretty much 90% of our therapists, so that the accreditation within the practice is consistent. And, you know, outside of that, they all have, again, their own portfolio. Some have, especially in the area of attachment disorders, and others have things. So it's about, and also looking for people, looking for that right person, that one that you can't say no to as well, that one that comes along and you say, oh my God, that's just amazing.
Yeah.
And or a program. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm open. What if you give good ideas? You can always offer. You should be going this area. And you know what? Never saying no to somebody is a good idea, but listening to what they doesn't mean you have to do it, but listening to what they say is important.
Fair to say Michelle's probably got a whole lot of plans for this year and next and the year after, and she'll just drop them in. She'll just drop them in when you're available, when you're ready.
We just spent 3 months overseas. That's the longest holiday I've ever had.
At the risk of us being on here for an hour and a half and numbing everybody's ears, let's maybe quickly talk about this, because you've just been away for 3 months, but I also happen to know that it was 12 to 18 months in the preparation so that you could leave your business, both of you. So share up a little bit of that.
Okay, so a lot of it involved finding the right people and then delegating and training and giving them the confidence and the support to be able to take that role on while we were away. So Ali Moss became the clinical director. She just stepped up into my role. We had a Michael, who then moved into her role as clinical manager, and we provided the right support and training for him and knew that he'd be the right person. And the next person down stepped up into his role as a senior OT on board every day, and they had that confidence going in. And I did not answer one call while I was away for 3 months, and they didn't need to. But essentially, it was a plan that was great, because we can now we know that that can exist. And you know, I can say I'm going away, Ali, for 3 months. If I wanted to do, you know, want to work overseas or something like that. But initially, it was prompted by running. We ran the New York Marathon. Michelle and I did that initially, and then we said, look, it's when we don't really take that opportunity, and we haven't taken more than, you know, nine days off at a time ever. So we did that, and that was amazing for the kids and for us. I still Googled every OT practice in every place we went to and had a look at what they had and who they had working, what dynamics they had and what programs they had, and got some ideas and things like that. But I didn't really focus on work, but that planning was very much Michelle and I looking at the staff and who would, and if we didn't, we'd bring somebody in. You know, we had that plan of saying, if this isn't a person that potentially could take that role or do that, are they the best person for this practice, and who is, and how do we find them, and how do we measure that, and how do we provide them with that feedback? And we've been very lucky that you know, that we were able to do that. And you know, that planning also involved for us about our therapists being our therapists, part of OCSC, not being contracted, not being paid per client. We pay them salaries. They are part of the practice, and increasing that incentive as the business grows, also increasing their incentive to be an even part of the, I guess, the financial aspect of the business as well. So, because otherwise, if they're so driven and so motivated and these brilliant therapists, why wouldn't they want to run their own practice in the future? But if there's an avenue for them to do that within our practice and to be able to let go of that, I think that's a good thing as well for the sustainability of OCFC as it is.
Yeah.
And it's a great adjunct to the clinical development and the clinical coaching that they get from you as well, that they're getting a really good transparency, if you like, in terms of what you're thinking and what you're not thinking about and how the business is running and what those collective goals are. So you're really, it's a great leadership skill to be able to share that up and have the right sort of incentive and have people working alongside with you.
Very absolutely. Not having a fear of them taking your information and your and taking that and using that, instead saying, well, here it all is. You can do that, but you can also do this within this, and we'll support X, Y, and Z, which you probably wouldn't be able to get, and we can work at this together. It is very much an us, not a we dictate. And I think that that's essentially what we saw as being invaluable to employees, is that they don't want more money. You know, they need money, but they don't want more. It's not incentive to stay anywhere. It's opportunity and growth, and what does that deliver for the practice in overall is I think is a more successful practice.
Yep, agree. Unbelievable. Oh my gosh, I've had such a good conversation. We need to catch up more often. So
you got to come back to Adelaide and see your family more often. That's why.
Well, I don't tell them when I anyway. We won't. I don't think they'll be listening, but I occasionally pop in and out of Adelaide incognito. So I know we didn't cover off on all of the questions, but I'm so grateful for your generosity around your business model and your awesome business and life partner, Michelle, and NDIA, and how you love your staff and your clients and your plans. Absolutely amazing. So one thing I offer all of my very brave podcast interviewees is the chance to ask me a question. So what have you got? Throw it over the state border.
Okay. And it's probably more selfish than anything else. I want to know when you knew that it was time to transition from that peds clinician to what you do now. I've always been interested into where was your mind at that point, or what triggered that process for you?
So is your question around when I was ready to sell the business?
What prompted that? And did you have thoughts beforehand about it's time, or I'm not having the energy? I want to know the really what your thought process was before, what triggered that, and then, you know, finally making that decision, what that was like as well.
Cool. Wow. Yeah, nice. This probably needs a glass of wine, but I'll make a start on it. I worked with two different business coaches at different times, and I may have even been working with someone when you worked for me in the early thousands, because I was in a period of really fast growth that I don't know if you noticed, I wasn't always managing particularly well. And by working with a coach, I just kind of had my mind blown in terms of the opportunities. And I hear what you say when, if I work harder and harder and harder, I will be successful, and it will be successful, and my reputation will be great, and all of those weird and wonderful motivators. But what I didn't realize was that I could actually work different and have a business that could run with less of my energy. And I guess I had thought processes about having my mind being open to other alternatives and alternative futures, if you like. And I also had the demands of a husband doing shift work and kids who were at primary school. And so life just wasn't always easy in terms of getting all of that stuff done. So I started to get more and more strategic, and I started to put plans in place. And like you guys, I had a plan, but I worked the plan. And my plan was busted down into quarterly goals, monthly goals, weekly goals. And I just worked that like a ninja. And I started to invest in myself as a business owner. And I went and did certificates, and I did courses, and I went to things that I didn't even know what they were. And I still didn't understand when I finished the day. But I knew that I'd done it, and that knowledge was there for when I did need it, kind of going forward. And so I started to invest in myself as a manager, and I went through three accountants in almost just as many years, I think, to find a really good financial advisor. I found a great lawyer who was a great legal advisor and HR advisor. So what I realized was that I was going to have, come hell or high water, an asset that I could sell. And so that was perhaps the anchor of my plan. So I started to sell my business 10 years out. And I really started to look at what's in the box And I needed clinical excellence. I needed a great team. I needed amazing customer service. I needed an online profile. And I needed a range of products, which, as you know, I kind of lined most of that stuff up. So I guess for that 10 years, I just started to gradually cut down the clinical work. And I'd have a management day one day a week, and then I'd have two management days, and then I'd do all morning clinical all mornings and management all afternoons. And I just played and played and played with the formula, and also played with the delegation, and really squeezed absolutely every drop of juice out of our practice management system, because I wanted as much to be automated as possible. And this was before there were loads of apps, and there was no Xero, and there was barely a website, and social media was just fledgling kind of stuff. But I just kept pushing more and more stuff out to other people, and I started to bring my advisors in for regular meetings, and we really got routines built, and we got policies and procedures built so that I could take time off and know that it was all going to run without me. And I think the business actually preferred it when I wasn't there by the end. And that could be, yeah, something that your lot might say as well. But I really, really worked hard to have a business that wasn't dependent on me. And that gave me some emotional freedom to put back into family, immediate family, extended family. And I timed that kind of luckily. I timed that when the kids were teens. And that was part of a loose plan that I really wanted to be available as a parent through the teenage stuff. I saw that as a critical driver in terms of the future relationships I had with my kids as adults. And so luckily, all of those planets kind of lined up, and I was available in the evenings. I was more available on weekends. I had variable availability during the week for pickups and drop-offs and guest appearance at school events. And so it kind of inched forward towards a sale, and the sale process took 2 years, but it got over the line, and that was great as well. So really worked hard on systems, worked on delegating, worked on building a great team, worked on investing in myself. I also invested in my mental health as well. No big secret. I've worked with psychologists and personal life coaches as well in those last few years to make sure I was making really good decisions and good use of energy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, do you ever miss that client, like working with kids?
I still have a tiny clinical caseload, but part of working, part of working with the life coach and good psych support was to make sure that I had my head and heart and spirit aligned with my decisions, and that I was well-placed for whatever was coming next. Yeah.
You are a true pioneer.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
Because not everybody thinks like that. I think a lot of people think once they finish as a PEDS OT or whatever, that's it. They'll move on to maybe a different area altogether, but you've got such a dynamic role within health that is still providing you with with opportunities and doing things that are amazing, like doing podcasts. When you said that, I just rolled my eyes and said it would have to be Kathy that would be something like that. Anyway, and these amazing newsletters that you send through on the web and things, and the information out of there, and the workshops that you do. I mean, this people don't do that. I think it takes somebody with more vision than just a business vision. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because there is a possibility that you fall short with those things, and people don't attend, or that you're putting out a lot of money for those things, but not a guaranteed solid return all the time. So that's very courageous.
Thank you. Well, back at you. I am just, my heart is exploding with how awesome you and Michelle and your business are rocking along. I didn't realize it had grown to the extent it has. So our podcast, Eye Roll and All conversation, has served us both beautifully, I hope. I've been just so delighted to hear about your business growth and your travels and your gorgeous grown-up teenage kids. So we need to catch up more often. But if there are any listeners who are still listening, I'm glad they've got to the end. I'm glad they've got to the end.
It's gone on forever.
I know. And I guess we've had some tech challenges in this conversation as well. I think we're on our third login to Skype. So the poor editor's going to earn his money patchworking this one together. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. And by all means, you know where I am. Sing out if there's anything I can give you a hand with. And love to Michelle, who's probably just out of screenshot now. But you'll have to go and tell her what you really said.
We will make a trip to Melbourne just to come out and have dinner with you again.
All righty. Well, I'll hop to Adelaide.
Have to, yeah.
All righty.
All right, Kathy. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Be well. Bye.
Big thanks for investing your time right through to the end of this episode of Private Practice Secrets. We hope you enjoyed this episode and all the other strong private practice stories in this, our very first season of Private Practice Secrets. If you're keen for some more private practice business info, we sure can help you out. Head on over to the nakerconsulting.com.au website and you'll find all sorts of bits and pieces there. Blogs, forms, web events, freebies, conferences and more. I'll spell that for you, nacre.com.au. Yeah, a weird name with a really, really cool story. While you're on the website, you are warmly invited to book in for a free 30-minute power coaching session. I really look forward to hearing a bit more about you and your business. And yes, you have full permission to pick my brains. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathy Love, Allied Health Business Coach, and I'm wishing you and your business a brilliant day.